Welcome to this Business of Music and Poetry podcast, where the life of a creative meets the real world. I'm Michael Amade, musician, poet, and author of more books than I should mention. My collaborator and co-conspirator in this project is none other than Clifford Brooks. Cliff is the author of Athena Departs and The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. He's the founder of the Southern Collective Experience and is the creative force behind the Blue Mountain Review. He's also the host of Dante's Old South on NPR. Our guest today is author Louis Baird. In the words of the New York Times, Louis Baird reinvigorates historical fiction, rendering the past as if he'd witnessed it firsthand. His acclaimed novels include The Pale Blue Eye, soon to be a Netflix motion picture starring Christian Bale, the national bestseller Courting Mr. Lincoln, Roosevelt's Beast, The School of Night, The Black Tower, and Mr. Timothy, as well as the highly praised young adult novel Lucky Strikes. A New York Times notable author, he has been nominated for both the Edgar and Dagger Awards, and his story, Banana Triangle 6, was chosen for the Best American Mystery Stories. His reviews and articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and Salon. An instructor at George Washington University, he is the chair of the Penn/Faulkner Awards and was the editor of the popular Downton Abbey recaps for the New York Times. This is a fascinating interview. We talk about everything from the beginning of Mr. Baird's writing career all the way to having his work optioned for a film to be produced by Netflix. Without any further ado, here is our interview with Louis Baird.
Tonight on This Business of Music and Poetry, we have Louis Baird, novelist and legend, who has a book coming out on Netflix. Louis, how are you doing, boss?
I'm doing great, boss. How are you?
I'm fine and dandy like sour candy, and Michael Amade and I cannot be more enthusiastic to have you on the show, who's done so much, and you're humble doing it. So the first question I want to do is, the one I want to ask to appeal to that humility is, when exactly did you find out that you're awesome?
Is that a real question, Clint?
That's a real question.
I was going to say, if my mother were alive, I would have thought she threw that right to you. My kids would so not agree with the very premise of this question. I've got to tell you. So now, one of the virtues of being a depressive is that you never feel yourself to be completely awesome at any given moment. So there we are.
The reason I ask that question is I've read your books, and there's a sinew between poetry and prose in the way you write. We've talked before about how you read all of your work aloud and before you're finished and on your side editing. How do you weave music into prose and into your dialogue to keep the reader intrigued?
It's interesting you bring up music, because I do think there is an ear involved to writing poetry and to writing prose. I think you have to have a certain kind of ear. I think you can develop the ear just as you can a musical ear. But I do think there has to be something in your brain, some hardwiring that responds to the music of words, right? Colliding together or complementing each other or something like that. So I'm always looking out for that. I'm not always creating it, but I'm always trying to. But at the same time, because I write in prose, I'm also trying to create a story that keeps people engaged. So it's that ongoing tension between the poetry you talk about and the basic brute necessity of dragging a story along.
And to curve back around to make sure people don't know that the awesome statement was simply a joke. How many novels do you have to date? I want people to understand the statement. How many novels have you written to date?
I have published 9 novels. The 10th is coming out in a matter of months, in June, in 2.5 months. So yes.
Yeah. Now that's a lifetime.
There's a canon. There's a canon here, Cliff.
Thank you for saying so, because if you didn't, I was going to, and then there'd be that awkward moment Yeah. No, I don't flatter. And like I do every show, I think that flattery is the only socially acceptable way to lie. And I don't do that. We'll talk about your newest book first. But Michael Amade has a question about how your book going to Netflix actually got that happen.
Okay.
Well, so I think before jumping to the Netflix thing, I think one question that I think might be really valuable for a lot of our listeners who are writers or creative people who maybe haven't been able to move into kind of the bigger leagues of the industry. So your first book, what was the process like for you to from inception to how did that get connected with the publisher, get connected with the agent, if you don't mind kind of recreating that idea?
Yeah, I kind of did it the wrong way because there's always people always trying to tell you the right way to do it. So
I love this.
I did not have an agent. I did not have an agent. So I pitched my manuscript over the transom to an LGBT publisher out in LA called Allison Press, Alyson. They're not around anymore. It's a strange outfit. They were across the street from Grumman Chinese Theater and their offices overlooked the playing fields of Hollywood High. But they actually did publish stuff and it went into Borders and Barnes and Noble and all those places. So, because I couldn't get an agent interested, I just kind of threw it at them and they said yes. I believe I was paid, my advance was $1,500 at the time, which I did earn back, I am proud to say. And then because I didn't know what else to do, I wrote another book and pitched it straight back to them. And they published it for, I think I got a $3,000 advance for that. Since we're talking about business, right? We can talk about
it as long as you're comfortable with it.
But I mean, absolutely.
That's doubling your advance. I mean, that's pretty good.
Double.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It.
And I earned that.
Thank you, Jesus.
You know, I earned that advance back, bitches. I earned it back twice over. But at some point I realized that I was being stuck on the back shelf of those Barnes and Nobles. Remember? And Borders. Do we remember all those days?
Yes. So,
yeah, so I was stuck on kind of that LGBT shelf somewhere in the back of the store. And I was like, I think I want to be in the front of the store. So I came up with an idea that, frankly, that I thought would be more commercial, which is a book about Tiny Tim from Christmas Carol. And it found an agent who then pitched it to a New York Press. So that kind of immediately ratcheted up both the money and the attention, because once you're with a larger house, a large New York house, then suddenly you get review coverage. I was reviewed in People Magazine and Entertainment Weekly and places like that. The late Entertainment Weekly. And so it just, that kind of lifted things to a new level. And then it kind of went from there. But Mr. Timothy was a historical novel kind of by accident, just because I had to learn about this period in order to write about Tiny Tim. And that became my métier without my even anticipating it or expecting it. But I wound up embracing it as kind of the truest expression of my nature. And here we are, how many books later? So that's, I'm on to number 10 now. So here we are.
Well, and thank you for kind of explaining the process too, because I love that you did it, you know, as you said, backwards, or you do it.
I did it backwards the wrong way, which is to say there's no right way necessarily, right?
That's the thing I keep hearing too, is there's so many wrong ways, right? Like, I'll end up being the right way. So one thing that I guess I would just kind of ask about your first few books too, because you were talking about being stuck in the back, shelves there. How did you go about thinking about the marketing process? Because of course, you know, publishers will do some marketing, but it's really the onus is on authors quite a bit to do some. Did you do much marketing or did it find its own people?
My first book, I did a self-financed book tour. And yes, at some large expense, which was tax deductible at the time, but still was a big, hunk out of my savings account, and kind of went around mostly to gay bookstores kind of all around the country, from San Francisco to Philadelphia to, how far south I got, but just showed up. The publicist there at this press just said, you know, if you pay your way, we'll organize these events. So that happened. But from there, once I got into a bigger house, like a big New York City house, then the wheels start churning around you. And they start saying, okay, well, we're going to set up these events for you, and we're going to send you to Chicago, and we're going to put you up at a hotel. And suddenly it's a whole other level of attention and detail.
So I think that is a really valuable, piece there, that you went on this tour. You were willing to kind of put this behind the book, which I think so many people are unwilling to do or kind of afraid of doing. Can you, if you're open to it, what was it like for you to decide to just do this? I'm going to spend this money. Yeah. I'm going to go out. I'm going to try to make this happen.
Yeah. Well, I found places that where I kind of knew people, had family or friends, where I could kind of camp out, you know, for a night or so. I did it on the cheap for sure. There weren't many places I went where I didn't know anybody. So I just found a way to kind of coordinate my book life with my personal life and make things happen. But I still remember some of those events because sometimes you'd walk into a room and there was a pretty healthy attendance, but there were sometimes nobody would be there, or there'd be two people there in the room. So I really learned, I think, into my skin in a big way over the course of this tour, because I'm just another schmo out there. And when you go out on a book tour, you realize how many other books are out there in the land, how many of them are competing with yours. And you are just one kind of little pebble, you know, floating in the whole sea of literature at this point. So it's very hard to make yourself stand out. And you have to accept the fact that, yeah, if I go into, Charlotte, let's say Charlotte, someplace sort of near to you guys. If I go into Charlotte bookstore, there may be nobody there. I remember I went to a store called M is for Mystery in Santa Clara. And I decided afterwards it should have been called E is for Empty, because there was nobody there.
Yeah.
That was with Mr. Tim. Actually, that was with my first book. But so what I'm saying is that every author has some experience going into a store where nobody is there. And you have to decide, am I going to do the Dog and Pony Show? Am I going to still talk about the book? Well, I'm just going to sign a few stock and move on. And it's a little humiliating, you know, and you have to really, roll with it as best you can. It's a tough business. I know you guys have already figured this out by now, but it's a tough business, you know, to get published, to stay published, to stay relevant, and all those things. So when people say, should I go into this business? I always say, I don't know. Should you? Do you want to go through this? Because it's a lot of rejection and a lot of empty rooms.
Well, it sounds so much like, and you know, it's kind of been my experience musically and with writing and so many other people's, that it's like you create this piece of work and it's like you're climbing this massive mountain and you get to the top, and then the publishing process is in front of you in the market, and you go, and it's a range of mountains, and you go, oh my God, what did I just do?
And it's a new mountain every day, right? It's not even the same mountain. It's just like, okay, I wonder how Cincinnati feels about, does anybody know me in Cincinnati? No, right. Nobody knows you in Cincinnati. So I'll go on to Cleveland now and see what's going on there. So yeah, it's tough. It's tough. And I know how tough music is because I have musician friends, and it's very similar. You just show up. So much, it's that old Woody Allen line, right? Just 98% of life is showing up, and you show up and you hope someone's there, and you hope that whoever's there is receptive and responsive, but there's no guarantee.
That's a thing.
Your career, it when it launched, I always call it the divine blue flame that we all have to hold within us, that you're born with and you can't teach. The tour that you funded yourself, that, you know, in the empty rooms, you have to understand what it feels like to have nobody there, or to have two people there, but they really want to be there.
That's true.
That connection too, you know?
Yeah.
But that jump, I want to know, we just kind of glanced over this, but that jump from sponsoring it yourself to finding that bigger house, how did that happen?
That happened with finding an agent who then could then get me into a larger publisher. And for those who are into this publishing world, there are many publishers who will not even look at your work unless you have an agent. So that's a big step right there. Once you can get the agent, and I actually think the agent is the higher hurdle than the publisher, because the agents are innately conservative. They're looking for something that's going to earn them money. They're not paying you any money.
Exactly.
They're getting their commission on the back end. So they want to see something they think is really going to sell somewhere. So that's a really tough sell to make right up front. And I know people who spend 2 or 3, 4 years just hitting up all the agents. They go through the writer's directory registers and they don't make it through. And it's tough because the agents, they're looking for a sale. They're looking for something they can close. So that's the big, but once you get that hurdle and hopefully you find an agent who has some kind of presence in the business who can sell your stuff, then it immediately gets better and you immediately get paid a little better and you immediately get a little more attention. But again, it's a tough hurdle.
After your first book to your agent, how hard was that hurdle for you?
You know, what was hard was like, I had a lot of bruising encounters with agents who were, I mean, it was just a lot of really rude shit coming back at me from, can I swear on this one?
Absolutely.
I couldn't with swear the on the last one we did.
With the band. Well, that's NPR, dude. I mean, come on, man. Yes.
Yeah.
Seriously.
There was just a lot of rude shit coming from agents. You know, it's like, you know, this is just frankly not, or just no response at all. And everybody goes through this. So I kind of happened to stumble into the one agent I had. It was a kind of a friend of a fan. I had a few little plucky little fans out there. And she said, oh, you know, this friend of mine, he's an agent, but he's a real gentleman. And yeah, so we hit it off. And but he wound up being able to sell this book. But I do think it was a combination of the concept of Grown Up Tiny Tim and the writing of the book itself. So it was a collaboration for sure. But yeah, I'm very appreciative of the fact that he got me and into HarperCollins was the first kind of big publisher that I had. And yeah, they gave me a fucking gold card.
Right on.
Yeah, it's kind of right. It's like I'd be like telling friends, it's like, come out to dinner and I can pay for it. You know, I'd be whispering it to them. If it can't be too expensive, but if it's a decent card, I think I can pay for it.
So you got me. So if I come out there, you got me. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yes.
That's
exactly.
Straight.
Yeah, the gold card went away. Straight. The gold card went away after that one. I think I abused it. I was never given another gold card after that. But yeah.
That's how they get you, is what it is.
This is my favorite interview ever.
But I remember going to Chicago. I forget which hotel was it, the Ambassador East. And we were in this big ass hotel and Tom Jones was staying the same floor. Like we saw Tom Jones walking. It's like, okay, this is not self-financed book tour anymore. This is like New York publishing money sending me to where the same hotel where Tom Jones is staying. Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah.
Did you see a big difference with the, in the book tours with having the machine behind you, you know, when
there's a huge difference
with turnout.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. Although I still got the whole joke about the M is for mystery. That actually was for Mr. Timothy. And that was an empty, there was one guy there. And I kept hearing, oh, there's a football game playing some nearby. You know, there was like, there's always some reason. Oh, you know, blah, blah. There's always some reason nobody's there. I never felt like book tours, since we're talking about business,
yeah.
I never felt like book tours were a terribly economical way of selling a book because you pay so much money to send authors their travel, their hotel. There's no way they can sell enough copies of that book to make up the money that you're putting out on them. And the hope in those days was, and this was in those days, was that you were building relationships with the booksellers who would then hand sell your book down the road and that it would work out that way. But I still don't know that they've replaced that model with anything. I think COVID forced them to kind of go virtual.
Agreed.
But what I've heard from folks in the business is that nobody sells books on virtual events. I don't know if you've found this, Cliff or Michael, but nobody buys a lot of books at these things. They tune in and they, you know, they clap or whatever they do. But they don't necessarily buy a lot of books. Whereas when you get them in a store, they're actually going to buy your book. So
I've noticed that with a lot of merchandise you know, it's funny to still in music, people are still selling CDs at shows and they're selling CDs, not because people play CDs, but because you need something to sell. It's just a product.
Merch.
It's hand to hand, you know, and the, it's interesting. You're talking about the bookstore, the M is for Mystery thing. You know, I heard something Sting was talking about when the police came through first time. They played it, I think it was in Chicago. They played a show where there were three people in the audience. So he ended up introducing the audience to each other. And, you know, like, just, you know, we all struggle with this, or even if it is a struggle, it's part of the process. Yeah. It sounds like.
Oh, for sure.
That being said,
I heard a story once about she was a mystery. I will not name her. Because I don't know her, but I heard this story from somebody who knew her. She pulled up to a bookstore. It was probably one of those self-financed tours. And the bookstore owner is literally dragging the cage down over the window and saying it as he's doing it. It's like, I told them not to send you. I told them not to. She's standing there just like, oh God, with her like, you know, stack of pre-signed, pre-autographed books. It's like, I told them not to send you.
So okay, so that's the best
hate.
Day ever.
That's hate on a whole. Oh shit!
Dragging the cage down. It's like, no, go back.
It's one of those moments where you either have to laugh as the author, or it's a dark night.
I don't know her, but all I heard was the line, I told them not to send you.
So let me ask you this then. So you know, it seems like that's kind of been my experience, and the experience of people I've talked to is that the book events don't, unless they're in your hometown and you know the people and they're specifically coming to help.
Yeah, yeah.
That if it's not really moving books and virtual events, which I've also heard don't really move books.
Yeah.
What do you think? Have you noticed anything that does move books rather than, I don't know.
I just need to say how refreshing this conversation is that we're talking about the business of this, because it is a business.
It is. And
everyone's trying to figure it out. I keep remembering that William Goldman line about Hollywood. Nobody knows anything, right?
Exactly. About movies.
It's the same in publishing. It's like nobody knows anything. So
and they don't want to talk about it. Nobody wants to say there's secrets, but nobody has secrets.
Right. I know. There are no secrets, right? They're just figuring their shit out as they go. So what I've found there have been actually two of my best events were in Indianapolis, by the way, which is so interesting to me. And both times they were built around a charity. So the charity said, bring in the authors, we will sell and we'll tell everybody that, if you buy their books, then a certain amount will go to this charity. So they would bring in hundreds of people for a charitable reason. You'd sell the books, I guess, wholesale, and then the remainder would go toward the charity. And they were incredibly well organized and drew hundreds of people in both of these events that I'm thinking of. So there is a way to do that. There is a bookstore owner in Columbus who, I don't know how she does it. She reserves a restaurant, reserves the bar, says, come on over, we're going to have cocktails, we're going to make this whole kind of huge social event, fills that damn restaurant with hundreds of people. But it really takes an entrepreneurial person, bookseller, to kind of make it work. We'll announce you know, Lou's coming tomorrow night. That doesn't work. But if you can really build an event around it, but it takes a lot of effort to make that happen.
It's absolutely worth it. It's absolutely worth it. I mean, and this is the first time I've ever talked about the Southern Collective experience, like on this show ever. And you nailed it right on the head. You have to make it something that's absolutely unique. If you say, I mean, I'm a poet, and if one of y'all say, Cliff, let's go to a poetry read, I'd be like, why? I thought we were friends. Why are we going to drive? You have to make it unique. And how do you make it unique? You have to put a spin on it, which it can't be cliche. And it's got to be high. It's got to be highbrow, but not bougie. It's got to be accessible, but not. Yeah. You know, I mean, again, that's the one thing that's made our organization work with these functions is that you don't make it exclusive to anybody. You want everyone to come in and sit down, but you want them to have a live music component and then the reading component, and then to have an organization or a charity that you're giving to. You know, I mean, and to have that be a genuine thing. You pack it out every single time for genuine reasons. And people leave saying, I don't know what happened there. but I would pay to come back 1,000 times. You know, yeah. it's the best advertising. Because one of the things I've stalked you a little bit, just enough, just short to be offensive, but just enough to understand what I'm talking about. Your reading style has a genuine theatrical flair. And we've not even talked about the fact that that flair has followed you up into Netflix. You have a movie with them.
Oh, yeah.
With Lincoln. So can we touch base upon that just for a little bit there, Fran?
We can. The book was, it's called The Pale Blue Eye. It came out in 2007 or 2006. I forget. It's been a long time. So it was immediately optioned by a Hollywood writer-director named Scott Cooper. I should explain for your audience what an option is. It's not a green light. An option is somebody, a producer, a production company, saying, we're going to take your property, that they always refer to as a property, we're going to take your property and we're going to try to make something happen over the next year or 2 years, however long you give them. They might throw some money at you or they might throw nothing at you, depending on the situation. So people in the know always told me, it's like, don't put any stock in this. It will almost certainly not happen because 99% of the time, nothing happens from an option. It just expires. And it did expire. And then I guess about 13 years later, the same guy came back and renewed the option. It's like, okay, whatever. And then within a year, it happened, which again, I was told it wouldn't. And it happened. Christian Bale was suddenly the star of the movie. And Netflix was suddenly throwing $55 million at this movie. And it's like, I'm just standing there like this innocent bystander through the whole thing. Because I have no control over it. And I was, of course, never told about any of it. I'm literally reading the trade journals about what's happening. Nobody called me. Nobody said this is going to happen. You know, nope. I'm literally get my Google alert is telling me, oh, Christian Bale's involved. Okay.
What?
Yeah, right. You know, the author is really not essential at this point. Once they get your option, they're like, goodbye, see you later. We're good. But I will say the Scott Cooper, who is the writer director, and it has, it's been filmed. The filming has concluded. The principal photography, to use the correct term, is concluded. So they're now going into post-production and it will be out on Netflix by the end of this year. Cool. So, but what was lovely is that this guy, Scott Cooper, was just going to kind of waltz away. Cause I was people in the know kept saying, they're going to trash your book. They're just going to walk away. And he sent me the first draft of the script and said, please tear it apart. It's like, oh my gosh, tear it apart. Really?
That doesn't happen that often, does it?
I know. I mean, that's really unusual. Wow. And I know that it's very unusual. So I did as a writing professor, candid but constructive remarks, and sent them back with the caveat, oh, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. And the first thing Scott said back to me was like, oh, I agree with everything you said. Like, oh, and then sent me subsequent drafts of the script to vet and respond to. And it was actually a lovely and collaborative process. And this never happens. This never happens. So I really feel like I hit the jackpot in some weird way. And I think I should just retire now because it's never going to get better than that. But it wound up attracting a great cast, and Robert Duvall and Gillian Anderson and Harry Melling, who's this really fine young British actor who's playing Edgar Allan Poe. I should say too, the book is about it's a gothic mystery thriller about Edgar Allan Poe when he was an actual cadet at West Point, which he was for 6 months. It's a murder mystery. So it's about, the original impulse was to set Poe in the middle of the genre he himself created with the murders in the Rue Morgue and those other stories, and have him fend for himself. And so here we are all this time later.
That is the coolest idea in the history of fiction.
Well, there we are. There
I'm saying it took it on them a, this show.
Yeah,
I don't know, and it'll lead back. My priest did not talk in figure eights, and it comes straight back to the fact that you're awesome and what you do. I think
that's what we're trying to tell people.
I'm not, exactly.
I've been trying to think of this for years.
And he owns it by the end. He owns it by the end. My job here is done. My job here is done.
Yes.
No, I mean, I think the words used glibly mostly, but knowing you just to the degree that I do, and have read your work, and to have you in the Blue Mountain Review that's out right now, it's always you all the time, and the teacher in you always shines out. Do you find that sharing your knowledge with others about what you do help? Does it feed you creatively?
That's a really good question, because I know you teach as well. So I think it does feed me. I enjoy being around young people and getting that, absorbing that energy from them. I teach at the undergraduate level. It's not the entry level fiction writing, but it's the next one up. And I don't have an MFA, so I don't have a lot of pedagogy. I just kind of, we do a workshop and we chat and we have a good time, but very few of the people I teach will ever become writers. But that's okay. I feel like it's okay. It's okay. Just do it for the love of it.
Because you love it. Because you love it. Because you love it, man. Yeah. I'm serious. I mean, and if you do, it'll lead you somewhere to, it's a catharsis, and it leads to a place of true clarity. No matter what you do with it, man. And you hit on the nail. And many of those people don't come to have anything published. They just want to learn how to say best what they have right here in their soul.
Yeah.
And it's the same, if I may, it's that same fire, that same divine blue flame, that if they want to take it and then submit it somewhere, that's the work that's going to be published. That's the work that's going to find an audience, because they love doing it. And it's one of those cliches that's around, I think, the most, because it needs to be. You got to do it without thinking about getting published. You got to do it because you love doing it. Yeah, but there's a piece of you that's going to hope. There's going to be a piece of you that you got to hope that somebody wants to read, but you got to do it, because if you don't, it'll choke you out. You know what I'm saying?
I like it. If you don't, it would choke you out. I like that. I've come to think that desire is almost as important as talent. I feel like if you want it badly enough, you will get better at whatever it is you're doing, whether it's music or poetry or prose. You're going to keep at it because this is what you want. I have encountered more than one extremely talented writer, a student writer, who just doesn't kind of carry through. It's like, I'm going to Greece this summer. I don't know. You know, it's the ones who, it's those, the pit bulls, right? They kind of grab it by the leg and say, let's do this. So,
I feel like there's so much more we could keep talking about and keep going. So I hope at some point we can have you back on this thing and go deeper. One thing that and you just said the thing about the pit bull thing. I think that's a great metaphor for music, poetry, for all of it. But I was wondering, for people who are listening to this, a lot of them are people who are maybe practicing writing on their own, or that maybe they're submitting and they're in that 3 to 4 year process of trying to get an agent, or they're in the middle of that rejection. Would you have any advice for them, or anything that they should really be considering at that point?
Oh, wow. I mean, just, again, I come back to, it's a tough business. So it has to be the thing you want to do, and when I say want to do, you're going to have to get a job, unless you're independently wealthy. You're going to have to get a job. You're going to have to make a living somehow. And it's going to have to be that thing you do an hour a day or 2 hours a day, the last thing at night, first thing in the morning. But it has to come from you. I will say that when students come to me and say, should I become a writer? It's like, I can't answer that for you. That has to come from within you. You can't take some authority figure saying, oh, yes, absolutely do this. So this has to be the thing that gets you up in the morning. And in fact, the very difficulty of this is a test of your vocation at some level.
That's so good.
This has to be the thing you want, even when the world doesn't want it, which is often the case. The world doesn't necessarily want to hear from you. So there has to be some voice in you saying, yes. There's a wonderful Stephen Sondheim song called Everybody Says Don't. from the 60s, I think it went here in the 60s. And it's so true. That's been true of my life. I think it's true of everybody's life. Everybody is always saying, don't, no, stop. So there has to be this voice in you saying yes. And it may be a really, really small voice, right? But if it's there, then yeah, then you're okay. And you'll be okay even if you don't get published or don't get recorded or don't, whatever. Because this is the thing that you need to do.
Both Cliff and I want to say thank you for spending your time with us. And we want to say thank you to Lewis Baird for an incredible conversation. You can find Lewis at lewisbaird.com. You can find Cliff Brooks at cliffbrooks.com or at southerncollectiveexperience.com. You can find myself at michaelamadee.com, worldpoetrymagazine.com, and worldpoetryopenmic.com. Until next time, remember to be yourself. The world needs your authenticity. Do the hard work and conquer your obstacles creatively. Remember to follow your heart, for it's easy to lose your head in this business of music and poetry.